according to the schedule here, the delivered price payable in full on delivery, with no prior commitment required, and including all tooling and other overhead, is $20 million. Additional identical units on same schedule for $4 million each. That's a lot of money. My name is Long John. We call this the party line. We're around from midnight to 5:30, 6 mornings during the week. Monday mornings, we get started about 1. We continue through till 5:30. That means we're around for 37 and a half hours a week. Now, I imagine you're wondering what I'm talking about for $20 million. Well, I've had a few sponsors. We've sold a few things. But I don't have OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland as sponsors. But they do have something to sell. Namely, a circular foil spacecraft that is available for $20 million. We've talked about flying saucers on the program many times. And, of course, we've talked with people who claim that they've been to other planets such as Venus, Mars. We've even had a man on the program that claims that he was on the moon during groundbreaking ceremonies, the day that they started to drill the hole, you know, from the dark side to the light side of the moon. And we've had a lot of interesting offbeat people. But tonight, it appears to me that we have two very, very solid citizens who represent OTC Enterprises. And according to all of the brochures, all of the booklets, everything that we have in front of us, and believe me, we got a stack of material in front of us, plus miniature working models. Well, with all of this material, I'm led to believe that evidently these men believe that there's something to flying saucers. And the men that I'm referring to, Otis T. Carr, president, and Norman Evans Colton, director of sales engineering. These gentlemen are associated with OTC Enterprises. And we'll be talking with them tonight about the possibility of making a craft that can go to Venus, that can go to the moon, that can go to Mars. The cost, $20 million, and after we have the first one, well, the rest of them won't cost too much. They'll be about $4 million each. We have with us this morning Ben Iskowitz, the cybernetician, and Mel Shaloney, advertising executive. And we'll be doing a lot of talking this morning with a lot of people, and I hope that you might call some of your friends and neighbors and tell them that if they're interested in flying saucers, this is one night that they should be with us. Mr. Carr, some time ago, one of our listeners sent me a brochure that was published by OTC Enterprises. It's a very beautiful brochure. It's certainly a very inspiring one. And when I read this offer about a spacecraft that would be made available for $20 million, I nearly flipped. And I mentioned it on the air. And evidently somebody contacted your director of sales engineering, Mr. Colton, and he contacted us, and that's why you're here this morning. Before we talk about the particular spacecraft that you intend to manufacture, I would like to ask you a couple of questions. One, do you believe in the possibility of flying saucers coming to this planet, the planet Earth, from other planets?
We believe that there are unidentified electrified objects in the air. We have seen three on three separate occasions.
When you say you've seen three, Mr. Carr, did you see them in the air? Were they hovering above a particular place?
They were going at great velocity, and they were definitely electrified because we had been working on the same principle for many years, and we recognized what we saw.
Well, when you say electrified, what other type of, if we may use the word saucers this morning, because most of our listeners understand that, what other type of saucers could there be other than electrified? Would they be gas-driven or something, sir?
There could be if we follow principles now known within our atmosphere. There are many manners in which a circular craft could be used. such as the Hiller principle and jet on the areas of the close to the foil, the leading edge. But in the instance of those which, the three different ones which we saw in 1951 and 52 were definitely electrical, and they were very close to what we had already designed.
I think you said the Hiller system?
That's right. Any system of circular rotation that can use a motive power such as jet propulsion would make an airborne craft.
In what way is your invention different from the unidentified flying objects which you have seen?
Well, we do not, naturally, not having been able to examine the objects we saw due to their great velocity, we can't say with certainty that they are similar to ours, but the principle, we feel, is the same. Our design utilizes gravity, electromagnetism, and electromotive force in a relative field to get its functional operation.
I haven't understood a single word of your last sentence. Without getting, without getting it all technical,
right,
could you sort of make it a little bit easier?
We will use this statement that we use an electrified center. It's a center power core. Now, this is what we call an accumulator. In the vernacular sense, it is a factory. It is a storage cell, an accumulation of storage cells, which provide electromotive force in the same manner that any known battery produces electromotive force.
Is that what you're holding in your hand now?
That's right. This is what we're holding.
Could you describe it to the listening audience?
This is a dimensional product. It is designed with the dimensions of space itself in mind. And we say that it is truly the geometric form of space because it is completely round and completely square. Now, in this, surfaces are all round. But when we show it this way, the surfaces are square. It has been proven in scientific laboratory that the very smallest units of matter ever photographed under an electron microscope are square in shape. This has only been found out within the past couple of months. We have known it for years and applied this principle into an electrified system. This is the center power core of our space vehicle. Now, what makes this different and unique and novel from a factory is the fact that this is a piece of moving machinery. It rotates. Our average storage battery is an inanimate object set in an inertial spot, and then the electromotive force is conducted by wires from this battery to animate some object.
Well, let me interrupt a moment, and I'll try to describe it further. Could you hand that to me, please?
Yes, indeed.
Well, it looks like two ice cream cones put together at the scoop end. But it's, the angle is a lot wider than that of the ice cream cone. There are a series of ridges. They look like places for gears to fit in. Is that correct?
No, those are, in a sense, turbine principles. They're reactor channels. And in where there is atmosphere, flow of air there aids in rotation.
Well, then this is one of the components of the drive. This is the battery.
This is the center power core.
This generates electricity?
This is right. This is a storage cell for electrical energy. In operation, it generates electricity. At the same time, it puts out electromotive force. This is the central power system for our spacecraft.
I just noticed that it opened up, and it appears to be hollowed out on the inside.
That is right.
Much, I would say, well, it's circular. The inside, when the two parts are put one on top of the other and they fit in with two pegs, the cavity inside is circular. Is there
it
any
is a
specific
sphere.
Purpose for that?
It is a sphere, yes. And each unit is a hemisphere. We call the center of this, its largest dimension, the equator. And, of course, it expands or contracts and expands to a point on each side. It's the union of two fresco-conical sections. That is what it is. Two right-angle sections. And we say that it is the dimensions of space, and we have shown how this comes about.
I'll leave the more technical aspects to Ben, whose background would fit him much better to ask these questions. I'm always good to you, Ben. There, I do see appearing in a Utica, New York newspaper dated Tuesday morning, October the 29th, 1957, an AP dispatch, a lengthy one, and there is one paragraph that says that you sent copies of your brochure.
You mentioned that his story is similar to the story that we've heard from other people who have claimed physical contact. This is not too difficult to tell a story. I have never had a physical contact. I have never seen anything, and I'm a non-believer. But I think that at the present moment, I am more than qualified to also tell a great story that would not only be similar, it would be identical to all of the other stories, because I've read many of the books. I've had the pleasure of talking with many of the people. This knowledge is not enjoyed by just a handful of people. This knowledge is common knowledge to the public in general today. I think that the only knowledge that evidently is not made available to the general public is the manner in which you should first orient yourself before you try to attempt to receive telepathic communication. No comments? Perfectly right.
No, it really didn't call for an
That's
answer.
Right.
Other,
You're welcome to
but I
comment.
would add a comment to this, that in trying to prove something in the saucer field is a pretty difficult thing. But to my satisfaction, I feel that Howard has had contacts, and I'll drop it at that.
Fine, thank you, Jim Mosley.
Well, John, this brings me up to one of my favorite subjects, and that is George Adamski. I'd like to ask Art how he feels about that particular contact case. What is your opinion on Mr. Adamski?
Well, I would say that I feel that Adamski's works are quite authentic. I know his first book, and his first sighting was observed by other people, and there was other information that seemed to hold true, that perhaps there was a picture taken of this. Now, I haven't seen this picture taken from an aircraft of his first contact, but there perhaps is one that may show up in time.
Well, this way, I'm sorry, it went a little bit fast for me. Let's start over.
Let's
say you read the first Adamski book.
Yes.
Fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and you say that there is a picture that may be available?
Well, let's put it this way. Van Tassel made this statement, and again, it is hearsay, because it comes through different people, but practically everything in this field is hearsay.
Yes.
But I say that it may come out sometime. Van Tassel claims to have talked with an Air Force man who claimed to have seen a two-hour movie of the first Adamski contact on a desert.
This man saw a two-hour movie?
Right. I'm quoting Van Tassel. He has made this statement in public. And so,
may I ask, who is supposed to have made this picture? I'm not asking for the exact name. In other words, some branch of our government, or did the Venusians have some equipment with them, and in turn eventually developed the film and turned it over to somebody?
According to Adansky, there was an aeroplane or aeroplanes circling around the area during this contact.
Not saucers, aeroplanes.
No, aeroplanes.
Yes.
And then, in tying the thing together, there was no definite statement made, but that a movie was seen of this contact. Now, that may come out in time, and I can go no further because I
don't want you to go any further, but you're certainly going to have to answer this question.
I am quoting somebody else.
Right. Why is this being held back?
Well, you will have to ask the people who hold it back. I will tell you of an incident that happened in Washington, D.C. in relation to this.
All right.
We went to Washington, D.C. to the Office of Public Information to find out what we could find about flying saucers. We met a young gentleman in the office. There were three gentlemen in the office, back office, and one gentleman in front office and the secretary. And they looked at us as though a few fellows with some loose marbles had come in because we were looking for flying saucer information from the public of office the Office of Public Information. Mm-hmm. So we asked, being as they were the Office of Public Information, to show us how they evaluated this, being as they stated there was nothing to this flying saucer talk. And they showed us an old blue book which has been mentioned many times, and said that this was the information on it, and asked us if we wanted to look at it. Well, we knew what it was because we had seen where this had been talked of or discussed before, and it was only up to 1948, and this was in 1954 when we were there. And we asked them if they had no later information than that, and they said no, that all the people who had written books on this subject were merely doing it for the money that was in writing books and selling books, and so that there was no further information on this. So Mr. Van Tassel told of an incident of where he had seen a B-36 bomber flying and a craft, a circular craft, of approximately the same diameter as the B-36 was in wingspan. And this was followed by an F-86 jet. And he had sent a report to the Air Force, as requested on their forms, on this sighting. And also another man who observed the same thing at a distance of about 8 miles sent in his report. So we asked the Office of Public Information to dig out this report, and we as good citizens would stay another day in Washington, D.C. and help this office evaluate the information of his sighting, because they stated that there was no information since 1948. So Mr. Stevenson, yes, Mr. Stephenson, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S-O-N, called the Wright-Patterson Field in Dayton, Ohio, and asked a Colonel Garrett to send him this certain information or this certain form that Mr. Van Tassel had sent in, that we wish to evaluate it in Washington in the Office of Public Information. And he asked us to come back the next day, and we would go into it. So we, instead of going back the next day, we telephoned to see if he had the report, and he said no, he was sorry that he was informed that this report had already been evaluated, and it was decided that it was merely a reflection off the B-36. This object was about 1,000 feet away from the craft, so it was a pretty good reflection, but the Office of Public Information did not have the information. So when you wonder where any movie might be, well, I don't know exactly where it might be, but you'd have just about as hard a time getting that, perhaps, at this time as you would one little report.
Are you implying that if there is a movie, that it's in the hands of our government, then? If there is. Is that what you're implying?
Yes, I am implying that that there are perhaps several movies, and they are not available. Bill Kent?
Just a moment ago, Mr. Hill, you mentioned that you felt that the sightings in New Jersey of
Howard Menger
were correct, and one of the things, in your opinion, one of the things that you agreed with him was his report of the emanation of energy. Now, I wanted to ask you, Mr. Aho, how does energy emanate?
Well, if you take a simple magnet and observe the effect of the field, you see an emanation of energy in a magnetic field. Well, then, in these pictures on flying saucers, you see a definite pattern of a similar type, but it is in the light form rather than invisible form as you see it on a magnet, but it has a very similar pattern.
You have to realize, Mr. Aho, that magnetism is recognized by science as a static force. A static force cannot be utilized to power anything without energy applied. In other words, it can only be used as a conversion factor.
Yes, but again, if you evaluate a magnet from the standpoint of science, you also find the statement that this is what a magnet does, but we do not know why it does it. I have an interesting discussion on that. I have presented this. I have attempted to find out why a magnet is a magnet, and I have gone quite a ways in that, and I will have further information on it as we do further research. But those questions, because of flying saucers, perhaps will be answered very shortly, and it may change many of our basic laws in electronics.
You made a statement before in reference to the Howard Menger photographs and in reference to emanation, and then later on you came out at the end of a sentence with the statement, have not been propelled by the method they are. Now, that's a definite statement. In other words, by saying the method they are, you are stating actually, in fact, that you know the method these objects are propelled by. Do you, Mr. Aho?
Within certain limits, yes.
Have you any evidence to substantiate your particular claim?
Yes, that's... I try to bring that out in my lectures to a certain degree, but there's still a lot of unanswered questions, but there is a pattern that is holding true. So we must assume, as we do in any other research, that you start at a certain point and you say, well, perhaps this is so. So, within certain limits, I could say that I perhaps...
You realize, of course, that the rules of experiment do not allow for assumption.
Correct. If that statement was made in exactly that term, that I know exactly how they are propelled, why, I will withdraw it, because... If I did know exactly, I would be building one right now instead of sitting here talking.
All right, I'll accept that.
Well, getting back to George Adamski for a moment, I wonder if you realize that a man named Gerald Baker has contradicted most of what Adamski says in his first book. Are you familiar with Mr. Baker's statements?
No, I am not.
Well, I have brought all this out in my magazine, of course, briefly. Baker says that the whole desert contact was pre-planned. He says that the photograph in the Adamski book, which Baker was said to have taken, he didn't actually take. It was taken by Adamski himself. And he brings out another, several very important points, which would take quite a while to go into. The point is that several of the people who were on the desert with Adamski, as well as Mr. Baker, no longer stick by the stories they told at the time. They contradict the evidence given by Mr. Adamski and throw the whole sighting into doubt. Have you anything to say on this point? It's a very important sighting, as you know.
Yes, I would stick with Adamski because, well, I have met the man personally and I have talked with him.
Well, I have too. I've interviewed him.
I do not feel that he was making up the story that he was telling.
Yet you have several men who disagree with him. It's only his word against, I'd say, three of his different witnesses who now contradict the portions of his book.
Well, man's strength is actually in his opposition, and regardless what you do, even if you wanted to build a hospital, you would find opposing forces to building a hospital, so we find opposition in all fields, so we will find diversified opinions also.
Arthur Aho, in talking about the Howard Menger story, you seem to lend credence and authenticity to the fact that he has told his story the same way so many times. Isn't it true that if a man had studied a prepared script and memorized it verbatim, that he would repeat it time after time the same way, and it need not lead credence to anything, nor need it or authenticate the fact that what he says is true?
Well, perhaps so, yes, but if you look at a certain pattern, I would say, that is behind the whole scene, if that holds true, well, perhaps it is more of a proof. You take the Adansky pictures for it.
Well, let me explain just how I mean this. If a man had committed a crime, and he were preparing a story which he would present to the police, he would take great pains in studying the lie that he is going to perpetrate so that he can get away with this crime. Would you lend credence and authenticity to his story merely because he can repeat it time after time, even though we know the man had committed the crime?
Morris, no. Would you say because a man repeats a story in the same way and believes in it sincerely, therefore he's telling a lie?
No, what I'm trying to drive at is this, that a man who will give a pat story the same way as has been reported by Arthur Aho, that a man who prepares a story the same way verbatim does not lend authenticity to his statement merely because he can repeat the same words over and over and over.
Mr. Aho, did you say verbatim?
No, I did not. A certain pattern.
The basic story
is the same.
Right.
Mr. Aho, have you ever seen a saucer which had landed?
No, I have not.
You said earlier that the atmosphere of the area around a saucer which you had seen appeared to be the same as the atmosphere of a planet. Have you ever been on another planet? Or did you get your information from people who claim they have seen this particular thing?
No, we observe a planet. Take Venus, for instance. We have not seen the planet itself. We see a condition around it.
When you say we, Arthur, who do you mean by we?
Well, I say we. We have an accumulated source of information which is in the books put in by our astronomers who make a...
Well, then let me state my question again. Have you ever been to another planet?
Well, not to my knowledge, I haven't. No.
If I recall correctly, you said you did not have a telescope.
No.
Have you ever seen another planet?
I have seen other... Yes, I have seen planets with a naked eye. Yes.
With the naked eye. Then you have thousands upon thousands of different items and things and conditions that may distort your vision before you actually see this planet. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Right.
Yes.
Now, this is another question, and I want to take you back to this cave with Van Tessel. When he was holding this, and I use the term advisedly, when he was holding this seance, supposedly for receiving these messages, you said you were there at one of these times?
Yes, I was.
Were you also trying to receive a message?
No, I was an observer.
Well, I've observed seances where people said that they were going to receive a message, and I've tried hard through concentration, merely through curiosity, because if this is possible for one human being, why isn't it possible for another? And I tried concentration. Didn't you feel the same urge while you were there?
Well, perhaps we all feel urges of different kinds that we never fulfill, so that has no bearing.
Now, getting back to what you said about the people who are trained for telepathic messages, you said that there was a danger or a possibility of people cracking up.
Not in telepathy, no. I meant in experimenting into, you might say,
psychic research.
Psychic research. rather than...
Is it possible that these people who cracked up were close to the breaking point to start with, and that's why had hallucinations?
Well, that's a matter of opinion. I wouldn't go into that too deep, because it could be a result or it could be a cause. It's rather a broad field, because a lot of them have run into it.
Yes, Bill.
Sergeant Paley, you have asked Mr. Ahill, I'm repeating, about mirages, heat waves, highly hypnosis.
May I ask one question, Bill?
Yes.
Will you say this outline for me?
Go ahead. I should tell the sergeant the story at this time. This is very comical. It fits in with his attitude on flying saucers. And it goes about like this. I have a good friend by the name of John right next to my home. He's a businessman. And because he was a good friend of mine, I gave him some flying saucer literature to read, thinking that he might like it. Well, he took it as a big joke. I said, that was really funny. So he looked it over all right. But his approach from then on was, whenever he saw me in the vicinity, and especially if several people were around, why, he would say, "Hey, Art, how's the flying saucers? See any lately?" And naturally, we'd joke back and forth, because I didn't take it too serious what he said, and he was really joking. This went on for about 4 or 5 months. And I was embarrassed several times, because after all, these other people were not familiar with what I had been doing in the field and so on. But one day, going by there, he called me over, and again he had several people around him. He says, "Hey, Art," he says, "come here." He says, "but before I say anything, I'm going to take back every word I ever said about flying saucers." He said, "Well, I was flying to Reno with 4 men, and we were all sober, too. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and we saw something that did not belong in the air." And he has a lot of flying time himself, as did all the other 4 people who were in the airplane with him. They said, "We saw an object that was green in color, a pale green, come in from our left side. It looked bigger than the moon would, if we were observing the moon, much bigger than that. And it went across our path in front of our airplane at a fairly, it seemed like about a quarter of a mile distance. And then, all of a sudden, it went out. The green light just disappeared, and all that was left were 3 small spots. And he said, from all appearances, it looked like he was looking into the portholes of some kind of a vehicle. He says, "I don't know what I saw," he says, "but I know that it was unusual. So we called the tower in Reno, which is a traffic control tower, and asked them, or told them what we had seen, and the tower attendant reported back that this same thing or similar thing had been seen in the area several times that week. I think he said 4 times. So he ended up telling me that he did not know what he saw, but if somebody ever talked about flying saucers again, he was not going to laugh, because he had changed his mind completely.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and this is Long John with the Party Line. We're around from midnight to 5:30, 6 mornings during the week. During that time, we have the pleasure of talking with many interesting people.
I've indicated before, you've talked about kaleidoscopic spots, static electricity, spots before eyes, mirages, heat waves, all sorts of directions. Now, Sergeant Paley, specifically, what do you disagree with in Mr. Ahill's story, and why?
I haven't disagreed with his story.
Oh, you bad.
I disagree with parts of his story. Now, many times on this program, I have stated that I don't disagree with the saucer story. As a matter of fact, I think at some time past, I gave John a magazine in which it showed a picture of the Navy's flying saucer built in 1946, capable of doing 475 miles an hour. I have tried to justify Howard Menger's story in that what he possibly saw was one of the experimental government crafts that landed there for repairs, gave him a diversionary story about being from outer space merely to confuse him. And then once having established that point, used it as a stopgap from one point to another. I don't disagree with saucer stories. I don't believe contact stories. And when I hear these stories where people tell me that they have a hazy photograph, or that they see the pawnbroker symbol in the air. And now the latest one is that we have an envious pawnbroker because his lights were green. I want more proof.
Mr. Fairley, Sergeant Fairley, I'm sorry. Let me ask you a question. If you believe in flying saucers, why should it be so difficult to buy a contact story? Unless you don't believe that the saucers are controlled by some intelligence, why should it be difficult to believe that there is somebody in them, Venusians, Martians, people from planet Clarion, that's a planet not in our solar system, it's behind the moon. Why should it be so difficult to believe that some people have been contacted by the occupants of these UFOs? That is, if you believe in flying saucers.
I believe in flying saucers to the extent that we do have intelligence operating them. This intelligence is the U.S. military, in my opinion.
Oh, I see.
And not from outer space.
All right, fine. Now, in other words, what you are saying, Sergeant, is that the United States government, since at least 1947, we'll forget about the fact that there's been people on the program who have told us that flying saucers, or that unusual phenomena is mentioned in the Bible, and some people like to tie it up with flying saucers. But you will admit that since 1947, there's been a lot of action. Kenneth Arnold was the first one to cite something unusual, and he called it a flying saucer. He coined the term. So for the past 10 years, the government has been flying these things around, and they haven't told anybody on this planet about it. And you are saying that the newspapers, magazines, and news publications, and broadcasters would keep this a secret. No one would slip up and divulge the information.
I am saying that it is a possibility that the newspapers do not have the information. It could be very classified.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the story, the illusion of being from outer space, was developed in the Howard Menger story.
Well,
I believe that...
What about Howard Menger's story?
Well, Howard Menger claims to have had a contact.
Yes, yes.
That they landed in his orchard.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that it was an American-made craft, an earthbound craft.
Oh, but then you believe that... Oh, this is a very interesting, very, very interesting point that you made. You now, Sergeant Paley, tell us that you believe that Howard Menger did have an experience as related.
Oh, I clarify that by saying if he had a contact, it is a possibility. It is one of these made.
All right, fine. Let's accept that. And you feel that they have misled him so that they wouldn't have to divulge the source of this craft that landed in his apple orchard by telling him, the occupants told him, that they were Venusians or Martians.
That's a possibility. That's a possibility.
All right, now, let's accept that momentarily. Let's go a step further. You've seen the Howard Menger pictures, haven't you?
I've seen pictures that they said were the Howard Menger pictures.
But don't you at least have confidence in me when I showed you the things, that they are pictures that Howard Menger presented to me?
I have confidence in you, John. I do not have confidence in the pictures.
Ah, well, in other words, you're answering the question before I answered it. I mean, before I asked it, you're answering it. So, in other words, what you're saying now is that the pictures are phonies. So, if the pictures are phonies, evidently the entire story is phony. And if the entire story is phony, then evidently no one is having a physical contact. And if no one's having a physical contact, evidently there are no such thing as saucers made by our government or any other government or any other planet.
Oh, no. I gave you the magazine in which the United States saucer was pictured.
Wasn't this something that was on the draftsman's table?
No, this was flying 475 miles per hour.
That saucer. Was it saucer-shaped?
Yes.
That was back in 1946. That's very interesting.
France also had one at the same time. During that era, one of the Norwegian countries, I'm not sure just which it was, had an inventor who developed a four-seater, supposedly to be put on the American production line for the family.
Morris, excuse me, one of the Scandinavian countries, you mean?
Scandinavian.
This is Long John with the Party Line. We're around from midnight to 5:30, 6 mornings during the week. During that time, we have the pleasure of talking with many interesting people, and of course, on Mondays, we get started about 1, and we continue right through to 5:30. 37 and a half hours a week talking with interesting people. I think some of you people remember that the other night I mentioned on the program that we would be talking tonight to a gentleman who gave a lecture at the New York Center. And I'm referring to Arthur C. Clarke. Mr. Clarke is one of the world's foremost authorities on the subject of spaceflight. Mr. Clarke is a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, and for 5 years was chairman of the British Interplanetary Society. He is a well-known author, and among his books are the following: Exploration of Space, Interplanetary Flight, Childhood's End, Against the Fall of Night, and Sands of Mars. I frankly do not know what Mr. Clarke's opinions may be as far as flying saucers are concerned, but I feel very confident that before we reach the hour of 5:30 that we'll know. And of course, our good friend Cortland Hastings is with us this morning, and Charles Leadham. Mr. Leadham is an author as well as a TV producer. The gentleman who I think will be of great interest to us tonight, as well as Mr. Clarke, is a gentleman by the name of Major Wayne S. Aho. Mr. Aho was on the program a few months ago, and I would like to mention at this time that Major Aho and Cortland Hastings will be giving a lecture at the New York Center Thursday, February 6th. At 8 p.m. The address is 227 West 46th Street in the city of New York. Subject: what can you do about flying saucers? Now, Court has been on the program many times. The Major's been with us once before. And no doubt many of our listeners who are interested in the subject of flying saucers will certainly want to attend that lecture. Again, let me remind you, it's Thursday, February 6th at 8 p.m., New York Center, 227 West 46th Street. Major Aho is going to give us some of his opinions tonight about flying saucers. And he also is going to give us the official statement of Major Donald E. Kehoe. I understand that in this statement, which will be read to us, we will learn, possibly for the first time, what actually happened on the night of the telecast of the Armstrong Circle Theater, January 22nd, over CBS. Later, I've been told, Major Ahole will also tell us of newspaper and radio reports of sightings of flying saucers being seen overhead by audiences of Dr. George Hunt Williamson as they left the lecture halls in the various cities on the West Coast, during which one reporter not only witnessed it, but also took photos. And we have a lot of other interesting material for you this morning. Major Ahole, since that Armstrong Circle Theater telecast, there's been a lot of stories going around about what happened. I don't want to know the facts at the moment, but I was just wondering. Do you think when a person claims that they've seen a flying saucer, that they should be put into a mental hospital?
Well, John, I don't believe they should. If that is the case, why, there'd be thousands of people in the world right today in mental institutions who have had these sightings all over the world. And if we went so far as putting the people that had these sightings, had these experiences in the hospital, and we'd no doubt have to hospitalize the witnesses also. Because there are a number of witnesses in many of these reported sightings. That is something that I would just like to discuss at some length later this evening and discuss the very interesting case of Reinhold Schmidt in Kearney, Nebraska, and bring to light everything that has happened up until now.
Do you believe the Schmidt story?
Well, let's put it this way. John, I wasn't there. I wasn't a witness. But I believe that the man's story has possibilities. And if his statement can be borne out that there were three or four other witnesses that saw this same ship, and the fact that these reported landings, these reports came from many parts of the nation, I have with me some news this evening about a similar type of landing story from Long Beach, California. And when you add that to the Loveland, Texas incidents and White Sands, New Mexico and Nashville, Tennessee, and the fact that these are all occurring about the same day with no relationship between them, the parties did not know each other, and they occurred almost simultaneously. Then we should begin to consider that perhaps the Reinhold Schmidt story did have some merit.
And just because you've heard a lot of other stories, Major Aho, you feel that there's a possibility that the Schmidt story is true?
Well, John, I received several letters from Reinhold Schmidt. I am aware that right today he's back at the scene of operations. Many people know that he was sent to a mental institution in Hastings, Nebraska, which I think we should discuss at some length when you want to go into that part of the program.
He's out, though, now.
He's out, and he claims to have passed every test he demanded, according to his letter, every test they could give him, and he passed these tests. And the same company that had sent him originally to Kearney, Nebraska, as a grain buyer, Put him right back in Kearney, Nebraska, still in their employ. So apparently some people have faith in the man.
I spoke the other day to the newscaster who's with the Mutual Broadcasting System in Kearney, Nebraska. Actually, he called me, and he was in the hotel room with Mr. Schmidt at the time. And he was under the impression that I had made an announcement that his Schmidt heard through somebody else, that I had made an announcement on this program that I knew that there were witnesses to the story. Well, I hadn't said that. And evidently, Mr. Schmidt had the idea that possibly I would know the names and addresses of these additional witnesses, alleged witnesses. And frankly, I do not know them. I know nothing about it. Court?
Yeah, I wanted to add one small addendum there, John. I understand that
what
one
size?
Of these... very short one.
Thank you.
One of the eminent citizens of that town was a witness to this very thing. But because of the ridicule which was heaped upon it, and the great amount of censure and opprobrium, he considered it much better for the safety of his own skin and the safety of his own reputation to remain incognito. But he told individuals that he had seen it, but refused to let his name be used.
I don't want to know the source of your information, but may I just ask you this? Is this hearsay?
Probably not. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there either, John, so I can't say, but I would say the source was quite reliable.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into our discussion with the other guests this morning, let me take a moment to talk about this offer. You heard the statement that was made by Major Ahol a moment ago. And I was just wondering, as an astronomer, and also I understand that you were 5 years chairman of the British Interplanetary Society. I think with that background, you possibly have some opinion about the possibility of saucers being interplanetary.
Yes, I think it's only a matter of time before we're visited from space. In fact, I had an article in Harper's Magazine about 3 or 4 months ago called Where's Everybody?, which was on this very theme. There are at least 100,000 million suns in this one universe of ours, and we're probably a pretty backward section of it. And we've only been civilized, if we are civilized, for a very short period of time. I'm sure there'll be thousands of civilizations out there among the stars with very much higher standards than ours, and they have space travel and interstellar travel. So it's certainly only a matter of time before we're visited.
Now, when you say, Mr. Clark, it's only a matter of time, are you implying that possibly they haven't arrived here yet?
I should think it's very probable they've arrived scores of times in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even possible they've arrived in historic time. I mean, since there's been men who've recorded these things. I mean, some of Charles Fort's accounts are very hard to explain any other way except the arrival of spaceships in the Earth's atmosphere. But I don't think they're arriving now.
You don't think they're arriving now? When
No.
you say that, do you mean today?
Well, I mean, I don't think they've arrived.
Or during the last...
months? In the last... during the century, say.
During the century.
Mm-hmm.
You don't feel that any saucers... or UFOs have arrived here from other planets?
Of course, I can't prove this, but it's my feeling that they haven't arrived. I mean, on the basis of all the evidence, if you feel
that they have arrived here from time to time from other planets, why is it that they have stopped during the past century?
Well, I don't say they've stopped, but the problem is this. Suppose you have to conduct a survey of 100,000 million suns.
Mm-hmm.
You have only a limited number of survey ships. Well, at a very rough estimate, you could probably only survey any one system every few thousand or few million years. And I should suggest that somewhere in some enormous central filing system there'll be a file on Earth with various interesting information about it, a few thousand years out of date, saying that this planet may be worth visiting in, say, what might be the year 5000 A.D. to us. And they'll work around for us again sooner or later.
I'm a little speechless at this time. Charles?
Yes. Well,
are you going home?
I am going to go look for this file card, to tell you the truth. The thing that curiosifies me is this. Why must they have come, say, in Paleolithic times, and why couldn't it have been, you know, 2 weeks ago last Monday that they brought the file card up to date?
Well, it could be any time. I'm just pointing out the statistics of it. Earth has been here for, let's say, 5 billion years. Take a nice round figure. Roughly 5 billion years.
Sure, it's not 4 billion.
Well, let's stick to five. I like the nice round numbers. 5 billion. We've been here, let's say, as a roughly civilized race for perhaps 5,000 years. One millionth of that total time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the chances of anything coming along in that period of time are fairly small. Now, as to why I don't think there are any visitors from space as of now, if somebody tells me they have seen a unicorn in Central Park, I say, very interesting, you may be right. If there really is a unicorn in Central Park, there will be no doubt whatsoever about the matter in a very short period of time. Similarly, if there really are spaceships hovering around this Earth, that is the sort of thing which will be settled as unequivocally as the existence of unicorns in Central Park in a very short period of time. It'll be tracked, photographed, observed in every possible way.
Well, Arthur, I personally do not buy the flying saucer thing, but I think there's an angle of motivation here. The unicorn in Central Park, I doubt, would much care whether or not he was established. But if our file keepers from Planet X want to do an anonymous survey, why, then they might, you know, very well keep out of the way most of the time, but they might slip a few times and a few gentlemen might see them.
Yes, but if they slipped at all, there wouldn't be much doubt about that. That's not the sort of thing that you can keep quiet. I mean, it's like the girl who said that her baby was a very small one. I mean, this is an all-or-nothing operation.
True enough. That I cannot fight.
Arthur Clark, on this program, I've had the pleasure and the opportunity of talking with a lot of people, and I would say I've spoken to at least, oh, 8 or 10 people who claim that they have had physical contact with Venusians and Martians, and if I'm not mistaken, 2 or possibly 3 of these people claim that they've been in saucers and they've visited other planets. How do you feel about those things, Mr. Clark?
Well, now, all these people who claim to have had physical contact and to have actually ridden in space vehicles,
mm-hmm.
they fall into 3 categories. Some of them are fooling you.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them really believe it and are insane. Others are possibly hoaxed by other people.
And there are somebody is fooling.
Someone of rather simple intelligence may have been fooled by some unscrupulous friends who could possibly have kidded them into thinking they had met someone from a flying saucer. I'm sure that has happened occasionally.
Well, I'd be interested to meet the man who could bring down this, you know, 60-foot pulsating object through the sky to fool some of these people.
Well,
this is the guy I want to get in contact with.
Well, I'm not discussing any particular case. I'm just generalizing.
Cortland? I take it that Mr. Clark feels it's an impossibility for somebody to have a physical contact. Is that right, Mr. Clark?
It's a possibility. It'll happen sooner or later. The point is, when it happens, there'll be no doubt about it.
Well, why do you say that?
Because this sort of thing does not happen in out-of-the-way places to obscure people.
Oh, well, if you say it's never happened before, how can you make a statement that it won't happen in out-of-the-way places?
Because it'll happen, if it does happen even in an out-of-the-way place, that place will not remain out of the way very long.
Well, what would bring it in out of the way?
Pardon?
What would bring it in out of the way?
Well, listen, let's speak. Suppose that there is someone, say a reconnaissance group, surveying this planet, which, as I said, is quite possible, and I think ultimately is a certainty. Well, now, what will their procedure? If they're anthropologists, they'll make contact with people, and they'll work up from that. But the sort of reports we've had so far are so unconvincing and so trivial, and they're so contradictory. They just, I don't see how you can possibly take any basis of seriousness in them.
Mr. Clark, I'm interested in the statement that you just made, that you feel that the flying saucers would not contact an obscure person. Is that right, sir?
Oh, no. They wouldn't. For instance, all the reports I've said, well, most of the people who have claimed to have made contact with flying saucers,
mm-hmm.
The fact that they're obscure has nothing to do with it. But they're, let's say, also peculiar, many of them. And I don't think you can deny that. Now, I'm not going to give any names, but I think you can fill in the blanks quite easily yourselves.
Well, no, I'd like to get back to... Didn't you use the word obscure?
I did use that word. What I will identify it. They might make contact first of all with say anybody they came up against. But you know that little famous cartoon, "Take Me to Your President."
Mm-hmm.
That's the sort of thing that will happen very soon after they have made contact with anybody.
I'm interested in your thinking on this, Mr. Clark. You made a statement a little while ago that you thought that possibly saucers or UFOs or spacecraft, that is interplanetary craft, had arrived on this planet, but possibly not for the past 100 years. Now, if this is true, and let us say that 150 years ago, some interplanetary craft landed on this planet and they accidentally contacted an obscure person, don't you think that that person would have taken the Venusians or the Martians to somebody of importance so that we would have a record of it in our history?
I think that's very likely, and that is one of the best arguments against this happening in historic times. So you have fairly well convinced me that it hasn't happened for this reason. Your argument is a very sound one.
So we might as well wrap it up for a night.
No, that would be most disappointing. We can go back to, say, about 2000 BC, and then what would have happened? It would have been lost. I mean, the whole historic...
That's true.
Well, the point is,
hasn't been, actually.
Yes, but there's very little point in discussing these cases because you can never prove them one way or the other, the early cases. They can never be proved. You can argue around them till kingdom come. And there's no way that I can see, unless you make a time machine, of proving that that really was an extraterrestrial contact. So we are really stuck with the modern sightings if we want to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Cortland?
As long as we're back to 2000 BC, which is a rather interesting and round date.
You like round figures.
Sure. A friend of mine is an Egyptologist, and he's been doing quite a bit of study in that. And he says that in the Book of the Dead, there are numerous references to spaceships or machines from space. There is some reference to sun, and some people say that these are suns. But in the next paragraphs or so, it will be mentioned that these machines blot out the sun. And there are numerous references to the pharaohs going out to have conversations with these people as being those beings from outer space of greater wisdom than our own.
Well, I mean, I could match dozens of these cases from... that you can take things in the Bible. I mean, you can prove thousands of cases, quite convincing, but you could... Not prove them, but you can build up some very interesting cases, but you can never prove them or disprove them, so really there's not much you can do on the matter.
The thing that, surprises me is that so much credence is attached to Egyptian mythology. Why not go into Norse mythology and talk about Valhalla and the ice gods and so forth as being, who knows, maybe frozen flying saucers? What is so much with Egypt and the Book of the Dead? This is what I don't understand.
Well, there's some very good cases in the Ceylonese mythology. I happen to live in Ceylon now, and there's cases in the sacred writings of Ceylon going back to about 500 B.C., where there are stories of flying machines and so on, which are quite convincing.
Well, the Book of the Dead is an extremely important book. It happens to be one of the bases. That's why I was referred to. I'd like to go back, however, to the point of actual contact here of much more contemporary nature than 2000 B.C. That is a little bit long. I would like to mention, go back, say, to 1947, in which Army Air Force intelligence officers had been investigating reports of unidentified flying objects at very high speeds in various sections of the United States. And on September 23rd, and in fact on July 8th, the Air Corps statement at the Pentagon is, and I quote, "We are investigating a flying disc report by Navy rocket engineer C.T. Zome and three other rocket scientists." Now, we assume that these rocket scientists would know a UFO from something with which they were familiar. And on September 23rd of 1947, the official analysis report from the Air Technical Intelligence Center, that's where we investigate these things, Mr. Clark, out at the Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, Sir General Hoyt Vandenberg, who incidentally was a friend of my superior and a very close one, commanding general at that time of the Army Air Corps, and I quote, "The reported phenomena are real," end quote. Now, there is no question there as to what they're thinking. Those words are incisive.
I think there's a great deal of question as to what they're thinking. They say the reported phenomena are real, end quotes, and anything beyond that is what you read into it and is subject to a lot of question.
They mean that they are real, that they are not anything that we have, Charles, and that they obviously are coming from outer space.
Portland, how do you know what they mean?
Because I am about to read 1938.
Good, this is what I would like to know.
You did that great. That was a good production. Thanks, Charles. You're a good end man here.
Yeah, you're a good middleman, too, Courtney.
The Air Corps in 1948, July 24th, a statement by General George C. Kenney, who was at that time chief of the Strategic Air Command, after the so-called spaceship sighting by the pilots and a passenger of an Eastern Airlines plane, stated, "We're completely mystified. We have nothing remotely like the machine described. I wish we did," end quote.
That doesn't mean that they're interplanetary, though, Clark. They may be from a foreign government.
It doesn't even mean they're machines.
It says we have nothing remotely like what was described by the witnesses, which means absolutely nothing to me.
In August, the date was withheld, but a top-secret estimate of the situation by the Air Technical Intelligence Center, later declassified but never released, stated that flying saucers were interplanetary spaceships.
What was that again?
Flying saucers.
Now, who said that?
A top-secret estimate of the situation. This is a document.
Declassified,
but not released.
Do you realize that recently, I think it was just today, they were declassified a document on the use of bows and arrows in warfare, which was classified by mistake, Mr. Hastings? A lot of this top-secret classified secret estimate, which may have been by a corporal and a demented corporal at that, is not very impressive.
I'm not trying to impress by whether it was classified or declassified.
Oh, I see. Well, what is the impressive part?
It was never released.
What is the impressive part of this statement? We've been leading up with my end man bit here for 5 minutes to this statement. Now, what is the impressive part of it?
Well, I guess I don't speak good English.
No.
It said the flying saucers were interplanetary spaceships.
And this, as far as I know, this was made by a demented corporal at Dayton, Ohio. Now, how do you know any different?
No, it was made by a rather higher level than that. It was made by a number of quite competent authorities who had access to the information and who came to this conclusion, as I think many reasonable men would do, if their knowledge of atmospheric optics and natural phenomena was not complete.
Then you're kind of go along with Dr. Menzel of Harvard.
Oh, no, I don't go in along entirely with him, but most of the confusion in this subject is caused by mixing up two entirely separate things. One, UFOs. I think UFOs probably exist. And the other, so-called flying saucers, which are our vehicles, definite vehicles, which are a totally different thing, and which
you
don't
say
exist.
Flying saucers are different from UFOs, and according to your opinion, Mr. Clark, flying saucers do not exist, but there's a great possibility that UFOs do.
I would say that there's a 99% possibility that UFOs do exist, and only a 1% possibility that flying saucers as interplanetary vehicles exist.
Well, Mr. Clark, I wonder if you could tell me what a UFO is.
Well, let me go back to this report of these gentlemen who decided.
The one that Cortland is talking about?
Yes, in view of the fact, these reports and this evidence, that these things were really interplanetary vehicles. This is a conclusion I came to myself about that time as a result of these reports. It wasn't until I'd seen about six UFOs myself that I decided that I realized they were not spaceships. The point is that there are far more fantastic things in the sky than anybody realizes, even the trained observer who spends a lot of time looking at the sky. And I don't see how anyone hearing all these reports and not seeing them could really fail to think they were spaceships. But they're not spaceships when you were to analyze the evidence. Now, let me give my reasons for thinking this. First of all, I heard all these reports these sightings made by competent people, and I mean, you couldn't say they were all lying. And they were very convincing and very extraordinary and very inexplicable. And then, as I traveled around the world, I've been around the world a couple of times in the last 5 years, I saw quite a few strange things. And I have now seen, I've just been listing them, I have seen 6 UFOs. By that I mean objects which were quite inexplicable when I saw them, which could easily have been interpreted as spaceships, which took a lot of explaining, and often the explanations were so fantastic I almost hesitate to give them. But in every case I was able to find out what they were. But I'm sure that 99% of people who'd seen them would have decided they were spaceships, but they were not. And this is happening all the time. Now, can I give some examples of things I saw to show you what I mean?
Please do.
Well, I was in London one day on bright summer's day, somewhere near Regent Street, and I saw a lot of people looking up at the sky. And I looked up too. And there, a long way up, were 2 black spheres close together, quite motionless in the sky. There was a very strong wind blowing at the time, and these 2 black discs or spheres just were absolutely motionless over the center of London. I will come back to this in a minute. I'll go on to my next sighting. I was in Brisbane, Australia, on my first underwater expedition to the Great Barrier Reef, and one evening, I was in a building about 5 or 6 floors up, looking out towards the sunset, and I saw, to my astonishment, a whole string of brilliant silver discs, roughly elliptical, flip-flopping across the horizon quite slowly with a curious oscillating movement. And I said, good heavens, this is it, you see. And I watched them go right across the sky, and this was absolutely convincing, these oscillating silver discs moving slowly. Well, that was the second case. I'll give you a third case before I come back to the earlier two, if you don't mind me taking so much of your time. Again, I was in Australia, in Sydney, and I saw an extraordinarily shaped cloud. It looked like a cloud, except it had rather solid edges, hanging above the city of Sydney. And this, again, was a strong wind blowing, and this cloud stayed in the same place and slightly altered its shape, but it looked like an amoeba. It was hanging over Sydney, and despite the fact there was a very strong wind blowing. But I've given these 3 things, and I'd like to know if you... I'll tell them to you. Can you explain them? I'll tell you what they were in a minute, but these are the things I saw. I'm describing them as carefully as I can.
Would you care to try?
The 2 black discs in a high wind of motionless over the middle of London, the string of silver ellipses flip-flopping across the sky along the horizon, and this weird amoeba-shaped cloud motionless in a high wind over the middle of the great city.
No, these sound like regular descriptions.
Quite, well...
Fine sausage.
And I mean...
I'd like to hear what you...
If anyone had told me they had seen these things, I would have been forced to accept them as inexplicable flying saucers, perhaps some kind of artifact. Well, the first one was an artifact. The 2 black discs close together high over London. If I hadn't gone to Regent's Park, I wouldn't have found out what it was. It was a kid flying a very large box kite that must have been about a mile up. But it was so high that its structure was... You couldn't see what it was, and of course you don't associate kite flying in the middle of London, but it was a box kite at such a height that it looked like 2 black spots side by side over the middle of London.
Was a box kite.
I went to Regent's Park and saw the kid flying it.
You saw the...
But it was a high... I've never seen a kite so high. I mean, I say about a mile up, that's a rough guess, but you could not tell it was a kite because it was so high. Now, this is, you may say, is a simple case, but this is the sort of thing that can start reports, right?
Mm-hmm.
I am almost ashamed to tell you what the flipping discs were, because this sounds so trite, and I had read this in books, and I had not believed it. They were seagulls catching the setting sun. Now, listen, before you laugh at me, I was born by the sea. I have lived by the sea nearly all my life. I live by the sea now. I have seen seagulls a million times, but only once in my life have I seen this phenomenon. Under certain conditions of illumination with a low sun, seagulls and other birds produce an absolutely convincing impression of metallic discs moving, oscillating across the sky. That was what this was. Now, the third case, this amoeba-shaped cloud, motionless over a city in a high wind, slowly changing its shape. It was a weird thing. It really sort of gave me creeps. I had to get a pair of binoculars to find out what it was. And there was a chemical plant of some kind with a high chimney, which I couldn't see, and something, some fumes, I don't know what they were coming out of this chimney. You couldn't see them when they left the chimney, as you can't see the smoke, as you often can't see the steam from a kettle. And it was obviously condensing a little way downwind of the chimney and then being dispersed. So it was roughly motionless in space, despite the wind, and it was slowly changing its shape. It was an artificial cloud, a byproduct of this chemical factory. Well, all these three cases are just examples of some of the extraordinary things that I myself have seen in a few years in the sky. And this is why I don't take seriously any report of anything seen in the sky. I'm sure that people see these things, but they can't interpret them.
Arthur, you mentioned UFOs and flying saucers. You believe in UFOs and you don't believe in flying saucers. Isn't it possible that because you have never seen a flying saucer, or at least to your knowledge, you don't know that you saw an interplanetary craft? I call them flying saucers because it's convenient on this program. If you've never seen one, and yet you believe in UFOs, isn't it possible for a person to see a flying saucer and not being familiar with its shape or the anything about it, that they could be considered to be UFOs?
Of course, it's perfectly possible. When there's so many hundreds of explanations of strange things, why on earth bring in an unearthly explanation and two exhausted all the terrestrial ones?
We've talked on this program to a few members of an organization that's called CSI, that's Civilian Saucer Intelligence. Located in the city of New York. And I might say that the few people that I've had the pleasure of meeting who are members of that organization are certainly brilliant, intelligent people that have excellent educational backgrounds, people like Lex Mebane, Ted Blocher, Ivan Sanderson. These names may mean nothing to you at all.
I know Ivan.
Oh, you know Ivan. I heard recently, not from these gentlemen, but from other people, and so far no one has denied it, that a few of these people, not all of the names that I've mentioned, but a few of them, believe in little men, not green ones now. In other words, actually it's been thrown out on this program by somebody that these men believe in little green men. Now that has been corrected, not by Mr. Mebane or Mr. Blocher, but we've had people who said it isn't green one. They don't even know what the colors may be. But due to extensive research on the part of one or two members of Civilian Saucer Intelligence, these people now sort of lean in the direction of the little men visiting this planet. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's nonsense. I mean, there's no evidence for these things, and why bring them in until you've eliminated all the other possibilities?
Mm-hmm. Court?
I don't think that...
You're almost speechless at this moment.
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm just waiting patiently.
Oh, I see.
I'm sorry if I'm being monopolizing.
Not at all. No, Arthur, this program here, you're liable to go for an hour without stopping. That's the way we work this program. Go
frankly,
ahead.
I think Mr. Clark is to be complimented on his examining into what he saw.
I agree with you.
I am all for that. I think there is too little of it. We need more of it. But I don't think that your experience, Mr. Clark, is any indication of the grand total. I have seen things, too, which looked like saucers. I didn't think so, but I wasn't sure. But in a few minutes, I determined very definitely that there would have to be much more solidity to what I saw to prove to me that they were saucers. And I have never seen one yet. As far as the little men go, I'm sure Ivan Sanderson feels quite convinced in his own mind after having gone down to the... wherever that blooming place was. where the landing was supposed to have been.
Are you talking about the West Virginia Monster?
Well, he went down that Flatwoods, West Virginia.
Flatwoods, yeah. West Virginia.
Yeah, but
that wasn't a little man.
No. I was just trying to think of the location, but I don't feel so bad, Long John, as long as your memory, which is as long as an elephant, can't remember where it was. I don't feel so bad.
I may have made a mistake here. Ivan Sanderson is not Hans Stefansson, the...
No, not Hans Stefansson.
Ivan Sanderson is the zoologist.
Oh, I don't know.
Hans Stefan Sanderson is the editorial director of Fantastic...
Yes, I know Hans quite well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ivan is a very bright chap and very well grounded. And I heard him give a dissertation one evening on these little men. As far as I'm concerned, I put it aside because I don't know whether there are or not. I certainly would credit Ivan's intelligence quite considerably because when he goes after something, he's a bit skeptical on these things. Let's say he's very skeptical about them. However, what I wanted to get back to is to some of these. If that Mr. Clark feels that there are no saucers which have been around lately, I would like to just bring out a whole battery of instances here, not consecutively, because after all, that would be taking too much time. But on November 3rd, I presume you're aware, Mr. Clark, that there were quite a concentration of sightings. They started, actually, on November 2nd. On November 2nd, the owner of station KCLV in New Mexico saw a strange glowing object speeding southeast. Now, he could have been mistaken, no question. But the Ground Observer Corps at Midland, Texas, logged reports of a large bluish object flying west at a low altitude. And that same evening, Civilian Aeronautics Association, is that correct, Wayne? You're up on that CAA? Tower operators on duty at the Amarillo Airport base sighted a peculiar bluish object moving through the sky. And one of the tower operators, whose business it is to know these things, said he had never seen anything so spectacular. Well, that's another one. Now, however, we get to the things that are going to be more concrete and where we can really sink some teeth in. At 1:30 on November 3rd, on a Sunday, a huge oval-shaped object was reported as landing, or very closely approaching trucks, on a highway in Leveland, Texas, or right outside of Leveland, Texas. Now, the sheriff investigated these cases, and in three of them, the close passage of the UFO had stopped the car engines and dimmed or put out the headlights. Now, two other men, Clem himself, the sheriff, and his deputy sheriff, saw the glow from the object themselves as it crossed above the highway and brilliantly lighted up the pavement. And this light was seen by two other patrolmen, each following in a separate car. Now, would you care to comment on that before I go into some others?
Yes.
They saw the object as 125 to 200 feet in diameter, I might add.
Well, now, this boils down to a number of separate categories. First of all, the sightings, the objects seen in the sky, those are quite different from what I was talking about in flying saucers and vehicles. They're what I call the UFOs, and many of those may be an unexplained UFO. I'd like to come back to that later. But before, let me recapitulate. Anything strange seen in the sky, not close enough to get you to give an idea of its structure, that may have many hundreds of separate explanations, and I think there may be a residue which has no explanation yet. You can call this a genuine UFO, which may turn out to be quite a new phenomenon. I have some ideas on that I'd like to come to later. But now, as for the reports of things that land and come down to Earth, people see things coming out of them, I just do not believe any of those. And this one you have just quoted, contains the seeds of its own disproof, the story of the car engine stopping, because this brings me right back to 1937. In 1937, 1938, car engines were stopping all over England. They were stopping near the big towers that were being put up along the East Coast, because those towers were supposed to contain a ray, to generate a ray, which would stop the engines of the Luftwaffe when they bombed England. And this report Every week you were hearing about Carringer's being stopped. Everybody believed this, quite genuinely, that Carringer was being stopped. This was absolute nonsense. They were radar stations, and the car engine reports were being put out by counterintelligence to make people think that this is what these stations really were, that they were to stop the Luftwaffe's engines. There was no truth whatsoever in these reports, but this was a universal belief. So whenever I hear about car engines stopping, I remember the same thing 20 years ago, and there was not a word of truth in it.
Well, do you feel then that it's possible that our government are putting out these false rumors?
There's no need to make false rumors, but no need to put them out.
Well, these had nothing to do with radar towers, Mr. Clark.
No, but this is a beautiful example of the sort of hysteria that generates. Someone starts a story, and quite possibly someone sees something and they stole their engine. And then that starts the whole thing.
And then they put out the headlights, too.
Sure. They probably pulled the ignition out.
Well, we'll have to go to another one where there are a great many more cars involved.
Well, before we do that, let me take a moment to do a little piece of business. I think you wanted to get into a little different line.
Yeah, I was, now that we proved that flying saucers don't exist, I thought, one point, Arthur, in your lecture the other night at the New York Center, you said something about satellites. You said quite a lot about satellites, for that matter. But one thing was, I recall you saying that if the Russians on their satellite had used, instead of the, on the second satellite, instead of the big dog bearing thing, if they had put a fourth stage on there, they could have hit the moon. Is that,
Yes, they could have hit the moon with a payload of about 50 pounds, maybe 100 pounds.
Why would they, having got one satellite up already, I don't know whether the second one was really for scientific research or what, but it certainly would have been a great deal more impressive if they had done a magnesium flare or whatever they're going to do to mark the moon.
Well, what they did with Sputnik 2 was much more useful scientifically. That was loaded with instruments, and of course, as well as a dog, and they obtained a vast amount of scientific information from that flight. So that was the obvious next one to do after Sputnik 1, to do the heavier payload in the orbit. I would say the logical thing now for the next one is an attempt to shoot something around the moon. They can do it any time they feel like it. In fact, I'm rather surprised they haven't already.
What value would it be for any country to be able to land on the moon?
What value would it to land on America? The moon is much bigger than America. And after all, the moon is only the stepping stone to the other planets and to the universe as a whole.
Do you think it would be of any value to us in the event of war as a nation?
No, I don't think so. We can destroy ourselves completely adequately with existing weapons on this planet. There's no need to go into space to set up military bases.
I agree with Mr. Clark. First time this evening. It's a pleasure, sir.
If we want to use the moon for any military purpose, I suggest we build our air raid shelters there.
What? I wanted to get back to this other little corroborating instance, because I frankly, Mr. Clark, with due deference to your scientific knowledge, which is vastly in excess of mine, I wanted to point out another sighting, however, of a UFO by a research engineer of the Air Force Missile Development Center near Alamogordo.
Months ago, at least 2 months ago anyway, we had the pleasure of talking with some people from OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland. We had the pleasure of talking with Otis T. Carr, president of OTC Enterprises, and Norman Colton. We've asked these gentlemen to join us again this morning. We're interested in what they had to say. We received quite a lot of mail. And I am interested in finding out something about Mrs. Margaret Storm. When I say I'm interested in finding out something about her, she was with us on the party line before, I think about 6 or 8 months ago. At that time, we were told about something about a radio machine, I think it was called that, that Tesla had invented. And it seems that Mrs. Storm was in contact with somebody who lived in England, and this person who resided in England had a contact with Tesla, who died in the late 30s. So my guest this morning, Mrs. Margaret Storm, author of the book to be published in the next few weeks, it'll be released. It's entitled Return of the Dove. Otis T. Carr, Norman Colton, Charles Needham, author and TV producer, and Ellery Lanier, the fact editor of Fantastic Science Fiction, will be with us in a brief period of time.
And we have a new gentleman with us this morning, new to the party line, Don Dunn of Television Age. There's a couple of more people. We might as well introduce everybody, huh? And my cousin, Rodney Dexter. Let's get it started this way. Mrs. Storm, I wonder if you can tell us what your connection is with OTC Enterprises.
Well, when I was writing Return of the Dove, I had almost completed the book when I learned that Mr. Otis T. Carr, had been one of Tesla's disciples, so to speak, and had been trained by Tesla. And since I was writing about other persons who knew Tesla, I asked Mr. Carr to come up and see me, and after we talked over his work, I decided that he belonged in the book. So I had a nice place between the last two chapters, so we just tucked him in there.
You say that Otis T. Carr was a disciple of Tesla?
Yes, and I
do. Do you mean when you use that word, do you mean that he was employed by Tesla?
Well, I use that word specifically because when I first started to do research for this book, A Prodigal Genius, which was written by John J. O'Neill, was one of the books in which I was the most interested. And John O'Neill made quite a point of the fact that when Tesla died in 1943, that his work was completely finished because he left no disciples, that is, no one who was interested in carrying on his specific work. So naturally, in my book, I brought out the point that Tesla left many disciples, persons such as Arthur H. Matthews of Canada and Otis T. Carr, who are carrying on his work very definitely.
In other words, are you saying, Mrs. Storm, that as the author of the book entitled The Return of the Dove, that you spent a considerable amount of time investigating Mr. Carr prior to including him in your book?
No, I didn't spend very much time investigating him. I had heard quite a lot about him. I was not aware that he had a direct connection with Tesla until he came up to see me, and then when I discovered that, I decided very quickly that his work belonged in the book.
Mr. Carr's work?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could tell us, Mrs. Storm. Of course, we're very fortunate that we have Mr. Carr with us this morning, but I wonder if you could tell us in your own words something about Mr. Carr's work.
Well, I do not go into the technical end of this of these matters because that is not my field. And I was interested merely in the fact that back in 1925, Tesla contacted Mr. Carr. Mr. Carr at that time was a package clerk in a hotel here where Mr. Tesla was living, and Mr. Tesla sought him out and asked him to bring 4 pounds of unsalted peanuts to his suite And when Mr. Carr took the peanuts up there, Mr. Tesla invited him in to talk with him. To talk with him, and that was the beginning of his training.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Carr, do you agree with that?
Thank you, Long John. What she said is absolutely true. We wish to state that we're very happy to be here tonight. We also want to pay a little bit of tribute to the tremendous audience that you must have. We don't know how many people it is.
About eight.
Well, or we don't know how many states that it covers. But we do know this, that there is an age of awakening, and that you do have a tremendous listening audience. And there must be a reason for it. And we are here to try to bring this reasoning into being. Now, insofar as our association with Mr. Tesla was concerned, he indoctrinated us.
When you say us?
Me.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Into the space age in 1925. We were much younger than we are now, and many things we did not understand. But this great man, this great...